Hi, folks. I'm Denise Howell. And next up on This Week in Law, we've got an amazing show for you with Suzanne Jacque, Kristen Thompson, Joel Waldfogel. We're going to talk about music and gaming, fart sounds, breaking the tacky barrier, and hand calling for ducks. All next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, episode 282, recorded November 14th, 2014. Farts and Arts. This episode of This Week in Law is brought to you by NatureBox. NatureBox ships great-tasting snacks right to your door. Start snacking smarter with wholesome, delicious treats like agave citrus granola. To get your complimentary NatureBox sampler, visit naturebox.com/twit. That's naturebox.com/twit. Hi, folks. You've tuned in for This Week in Law. I'm Denise Howell, and we're so thrilled that you've joined us today because we have just an exceptional panel here today. I know there are a lot of people who used to watch tech TV and remember John C. Dvorak's show, Big Thinkers. All three of our panelists would have been great guests on that show, would be great guests on our triangulation show, but we are so lucky to have them here on This Week in Law. We have two big thinkers about music revenues, piracy, and the like. And so we're going to have some great chats about the current state of music streaming and music consumption in general. And to help us do that, let me introduce them to you. We have Kristen Thompson from the Future of Music Coalition and its great summit. Kristen's just a really interesting person. Do you still run an indie music label, or is that now in your past, Kristen?
Simple Machines exists in catalog form. So we are still the custodian of an independent record label.
So wonderful experience, direct experience there with the concerns of musicians and artists and getting their getting themselves paid these days. And also she's a guitarist in a band called Ken. And I've listened to a couple of your tracks now, Kristen, and have decided your band is sort of the love child of Johnny Rotten and Susie Sue. Does that work for you?
Ooh, yeah. Throw in some Chrissy Hynde and I'll be psyched.
Yeah, absolutely. Chrissy Hynde in there too. And I've also decided it was probably the soundtrack that Angelina Jolie had on in the background as she was rehearsing for her role in Maleficent. But that probably would have given her just the right note.
I'll pass that along.
Yeah. So we're thrilled to have you on the show and looking forward to having you help us understand the convoluted world of music revenues these days. And also helping us get the economist's perspective on that, we have Joel Waldfogel, who is the Frederick R. Kappel Chair in Applied Economics at the University of Minnesota's Carlson School of Management. Hi, Joel. It's great to have you.
Hi.
Really wonderful writing and research that you've done over the years. Tons of looking into the impact of piracy on creativity, which I think you might have some, you know, as couched as it could be in all the appropriate caveats, good news for us on that front. And definitely, I think economics in general might get a bad rap for it being sleep inducing. And probably people think, since we talk about law on our show, that can be sleep inducing too. But I find what you do fascinating. So I'm hoping our audience will as well.
Wonderful.
Also joining us is a third year law student at the Chicago Kent School of Law. Her name is Suzanne Jacque, and she is Zed the Gamer. That's her Twitter handle. And she's a gamer and someone who pays close attention to and writes about game development law and video game law in general at a couple of different places. Game Dev Law is one of her blogs, and also Loading Law. Anywhere else where you are writing and contributing these days?
Law of the Game, the International Game Developers Perspective Newsletter. And I'm writing on a quick couple big law review articles, but those aren't out yet.
Great. So, you know, I'm very interested in video game law, but do not specialize in that area. We talk about it. It comes up from time to time on the show. So we're thrilled to have you here today to help shed some light, not just on the IP issues, which I think people, you know, are pretty familiar with, or at least that might be the first thing that pops to mind. But there are other things that come up, too. So let's get into all of that. You can tell is in the realm of what I would consider entertainment. So let's play our bumper and get on our way. All right, so let's start out with music, if we could. YouTube this week, just a couple days ago, made a big announcement about how it's going to better accommodate music listening on its service. I think this is a big deal and a big development in the world of how artists get paid. Interesting, and we haven't touched on it yet, but has been unfolding for the last couple of weeks, is Taylor Swift's decision to pull her music off Spotify. And I think it's really interesting to consider those two things side by side, because there's all kinds of Taylor Swift on YouTube. And I think that's largely because of Vevo. Am I right about that, Kristen?
I am not entirely sure about Taylor Swift's presence on Vevo, on YouTube, on whether it's constrained to Vevo. But your broader point about the, you know, the big amount of news this week is really true. I mean, there's a lot going on, not only with the conversations about Taylor Swift and others like Jason Aldean deciding to not make their new releases, and in fact, in Taylor's case, existing or earlier releases available on Spotify, and then YouTube saying, hey, we're going beta with a platform that they have talked about for at least a year, which is sort of a premium platform where they would have subscribers, they would have a tier that was for subscribers only. And, you know, they're sort of saying it'll be $9.99, but there's currently a $7.99 starter price to figure out if they can convert people who are currently watching YouTube for free with ads underwriting the cost to paid subscribers. And it would be, I mean, YouTube has the largest global audience for music. And so it'll be really interesting to see if they can convert YouTube watchers to YouTube subscribers.
Yeah, it's an interesting model. It's a little bit different than their Google Play model for music, but I assume they're going to try and merge the two in some way. That would make some kind of sense, don't you think?
Yeah, I've heard that they're going to try and integrate all of their music services, including the Locker and Google Play, into one, I assume, quite cohesive experience, so that I would assume they'll try and make it as seamless as possible to make sure that the user sees the maximum benefit of being a subscriber, so they attract people to a paid version of the platform.
So, Joel, you've done a lot of work over the years on piracy and its effects. I think, you know, as we sit here today, there are so many legal alternatives for people, with the YouTube offering being just the latest on the block. Can you give us an overview of what you think those legal alternatives mean? And are we making a dent in piracy? And I know you've done, as we touched on before, lots of work on whether piracy impacts creativity. So why don't you, in a nutshell, give us where you think we stand today?
Sure. I think, you know, ever since Napster, piracy has been a big deal. And if you just look at the revenue to recorded music in the U.S. or even around the world, you see that it used to rise essentially every year. And since 1999, the year Napster appeared, it's been falling. And even when you add the digital revenues, revenues from sale of digital music at iTunes and so forth back in, it's still way below where it used to be. You know, in and of itself, piracy has been very bad news for the revenue to recorded music. Now, It's probably true, you know, that that the availability of lots of legal ways to stream music makes piracy less attractive. But having said that, you know, we thought before the iTunes Music Store existed that if only there were an attractive way to buy a la carte songs, that piracy would decline. And, you know, in my studies, I didn't see the appearance of a way to buy one song at a time for 99 cents to really have much of an impact on piracy or its impact on sales. So I think piracy remains a huge, let's say, source of reduction in revenue. Now, whether that causes a global problem is kind of a different question, but piracy in and of itself has been bad news and continues to be bad news for revenue.
But bad news for revenue, as you've written, doesn't necessarily mean bad news for availability or quality of music. Can you flesh that out a bit for
us? Yeah, sure. I mean, so if nothing else had happened, if the only thing that had happened was a reduction in the ability of the sellers to generate revenue, then we would have expected to see a reduction in the amount of music brought to market. Because after all, although artists are artists, they still have to cover their costs, and there are intermediaries who need to cover their costs. But the other thing that seems to have happened, I shouldn't say seems to, clearly has happened, along with digitization and along with the bad news from Napster, has been a big reduction in the cost of bringing new products to market. Now, we think about what copyright is for. Copyright is really not a revenue guarantee policy. Instead, copyright is meant to provide adequate incentives to see that new products are brought forth, you know, products with some value to society. So that means the relevant way to think about whether the system is working is not how much revenue are sellers making, but rather how much new music is being brought to market. And more importantly, is it music that has some value and use to consumers? And by those metrics, we're really living in a golden age. And we have been, to a greater extent ever since, you know, I wouldn't date it to Napster, but if you do look since Napster, there's been really a growth in the amount and by some, let me be controversial, by some measures, quality as well of music.
Yeah, let's delve into that a bit. You have an article where you give some of your foundations for that approach. How can one decide whether we have quality music or not?
Yeah, no, quality is in some ways a bad word. So let me back off the word, although I can sort of fight it on both fronts if we want. But let's just think about whether music is useful to people. That is, whatever it is that would cause people to want to obtain it, let's call that animating force quality. So if a lot of people want something, or the way I think about it is, let's look at the vintages of music brought to market, you know, year by year back to 1960. So how do I go about it? There are two basic ways I go about looking at this. One is a little bit more like traditional aesthetic notions of quality, because it's based on what critics say. So critics periodically make these best of the decade or best of all time lists. And if you gather together many such lists, you can ask, well, how many of the songs or albums came from this year versus that year? And if you sort of splice those lists together, what you see is that according to critics' notions of the best stuff, you see a growth in this stuff from 1960 to 1970. You see that it declines from 70 into the mid-80s. And then, it doesn't do much after that. And then, interestingly, after 1999, when revenue just plummets, it's fallen about 70% in the big economies since 1999. Well, by contrast, this measure of quality just flatlines. It does not decline. Now, I think a better measure of quality is something that relies on the behavior and decisions of actual consumers. So, my preferred way of thinking about it is to look at data on the sale of music by both calendar time and vintage. Now, this is a little complicated, but let me see if I can explain it in a way that doesn't make economics seem as dry as it is. At any point in time, new music sells more than old music. And that's just an effect you could call depreciation. But the question is, after accounting for that depreciation, are there some vintages that sell more than others? If so, then that would say those vintages are in some sense more useful. We could call it quality, but again, that's just an invitation to a barroom brawl. Anyways, if you do that, so I have data on sales by calendar time and by vintage of original release. When you do that, you get back something very interesting. The vintage effects from that kind of approach rise from 1960 to 1970. And by the way, that's very familiar from what the critics said. They fall from 1970 to the 80s. They're rising and then falling a bit toward the end of the 90s. And then here's the really interesting part. They then rise pretty substantially after 1999. So into the present decade, they rise pretty sharply to levels, you know, not seen since the mid-70s. You might say not since the Doobie Brothers were active have we had such high quality music, but
I don't know if that's how I would put it, but okay.
Well, I say that to leaven it a little bit, because again, it's really not about aesthetic quality. It's about the recent vintages selling a lot given how old they are.
Yeah. Okay. I get it. And I guess we could throw the Guardians of the Galaxy soundtrack into that mix as well. But there's some darn fine 70s music. Yeah.
Well, sometimes to diffuse the inevitable argument, I'll just say, look, we have to all stipulate that Britney Spears is very high quality because it sold a lot. And similarly, if you think about books, other media that I study a lot, we have to just stipulate that 50 Shades of Grey is the best book ever written.
Okay, so stipulated. You've got me. Mm-hmm. Kristen, so we're talking about piracy and its impact on creativity and creativity not dying as a result of it. It seems like when you look at the graph that's present in Joel's article that we have in our discussion points, and Victor was just putting up for those of you watching the video, our discussion points are at delicious.com/thisweekinlaw/282 for everything we're talking about today. Does it seem to you like the availability of digital tools, not just to consumers, but now that musicians, I almost said, sure, that's interchangeable. Now that they have a greater familiarity and hands-on experience with those tools as well, and the distribution channels, do you think that that's having an impact?
Yeah, I really think that Joel's point about the reduction in the cost of creation is worth underscoring, because it's very true that, and we're not just talking about, oh, people deciding to record on their laptops, which does happen. I'm talking about the fact that it used to, you know, prior to 1999, getting music into a retail setting meant manufacturing CDs or vinyl, figuring out the distribution channels, trying to get a distributor to represent you, getting the chain goes on and on. And then part of that chain was also making sure you were paid for the sales and you were up against a very constrained, floor space in retail. So there was a lot of effort put into making your music available in a retail setting. And, you know, 1999, 2000, we see the emergence of digital music stores. iTunes is the most dominant, but there were predecessors that were, you know, starting to pave the way for this. But musicians' access to getting your music into iTunes is so easy now. It's a minimal charge, just a nominal fee to use a service like CD Baby or to use a service like TuneCore to get your music into the stores on a global scale. And that includes not only iTunes and Amazon, but also all the streaming services that we've been talking about. Then there are other platforms like Bandcamp that are providing musicians with these tools at a really affordable price to make their music just available 24/7. So all of those things that were a burden or real hurdle before, manufacturing and distributing music, physical music, are really much easier now. So the marketplace is so much more open for people to participate in it. So you see a huge amount of musicians just doing it. So I think that really underscores some of the findings of Joel's paper about the volume of music that's available.
Right. So is this the death of the big music labels inevitably then?
No, I don't think so. And the thing that the big labels have is legacy catalog. And we should talk about that too, because running a little tiny legacy record label, we put out about 70 records in the 1990s. In the 1990s, oftentimes we would make, say, 1,000 seven inches or something. And our goal was to sell them all. You know, we'd keep a few copies for ourselves, but our goal was to just sell them all. And then we'd be done and we'd put out something else. But now things can stay in print forever if you want. There's records that we had that were out of print that are now back in print because they're available on digital platforms. And now multiply it by the recorded music that came out in the 70s, 80s, 90s, there's a huge amount of music that's available to stores, I mean, to digital platforms, so that consumers can listen to it. And a lot of that legacy catalog is owned by the big labels, which not only provides them with revenue off of existing catalog, but it also gives them leverage at the bargaining table as far as what the services want to be make available to consumers to make them the most robust and, you know, the most robust and complete catalogs available.
I wanted to just jump in to Suzanne's brain for a minute. We're talking about music here, but it seems to me there are a lot of parallels in the gaming world. We see, you know, we've had traditional gaming distribution for a long time. There have been pirated games that have impacted sales. Now we have Steam and presumably other ways to distribute games that are disruptive in the way that the streaming services are for the music industry. Do you see a parallel here?
I see all the parallels.
Yeah.
The production of games is getting easier. The tools are more available. Smaller teams are able to make games. And then instead of the traditional model where you had to find a publisher who was willing to stamp your game onto a disc and distribute it through the game stores, you now have the option of putting it on Steam or putting it on the Xbox Marketplace and selling directly to the consumers. And with something like Steam, or even through your own website. I know a couple of people that are distributing directly online and using PayPal payments to deal with the money side of things. A friend of mine here in Chicago recently released a game for free, and within the week it was on the Pirate Bay being distributed illegally, which was strange because I don't know that that disruption was necessary. It seems like overall video games are moving in the same direction of as music in that even though you're making less money off of these video games that are produced by smaller teams, the quality and variety has just exploded.
And I think it's probably safe to say, you know, that as we're talking about these economic kinds of concerns in the music industry, that there's not only crossover to the gaming industry, but also the movie industry, the book industry, creativity in general, when it's digitized and made available online, there are going to be some common threads across industries. So bear that in mind as we're talking about music and as we're talking now specifically, because this is really Kristen's thing she's working on these days, about money and how artists are making money. Give us the overview, Kristen, in the complex marketplace that we're dealing with today, where music is available in so many forms. How are artists doing, and is the future bright or bleak?
I think that it's a little bit hard to have a, you know, specific answer there. But I will tell you this, that similar to the conversation that we just had about how easy it is to manufacture and distribute and just get your music out there, and the, you know, multiple platforms available for music to be distributed and lots of the options that are out there, there's been a similar growth in the number of revenue streams available to musicians. And this is basically, so many of the revenue streams are a reflection of the contours of, and I'm talking about the United States, the contours of U.S. copyright law and business practice. And these contours determine what kind of rights the composer and the recording artist have, and what you can do with those exclusive rights, and then how you can, you know, make money off of your exclusive rights. And so there's been this traditional set of revenue streams available to musicians, like, for example, you know, selling recorded music. But now there's about 10 different ways you could sell recorded music. You know, you could sell it in a retail setting. You can sell it in a digital setting. You can sell it at a store. I mean, at the merchandise table at your show. Then there's these new iterations of selling sound recordings that are sort of a slightly different version of it, like streaming services. And then there's now a new right that didn't exist prior to 1998 called the digital performance royalty, which is this royalty that comes when your music is digitally performed on non-interactive webcasting services like Pandora or SiriusXM or any other webcast station. And so that right is new. And so there's this millions of dollars that have flowed back to rights holders, to performers and record labels because of this new right. So simultaneous to the growth and explosion of platforms, we've also seen some growth and expansion in the number of ways that music and musicians can make money.
Go ahead.
Your screen shows a good example of what's going on. I should say, though, it doesn't mean that, you know, there's just money piling up everywhere. Oftentimes, the expansion in the number of revenue streams has also meant that it's quite dispersed, it's quite atomized, and that many of the revenue streams have are based on fractions of pennies or really tiny fractions of revenue in the singular form. And the, you know, many times it's often based on how many can we accumulate over time, like whether it's the number of streams on Spotify or the number of simultaneous users listening to my music via a webcast service like Pandora. So there's all those things going on with sound recordings and compositions. And then there's this whole other world of how you can make money based on your performance, whether you're going out and playing shows or whether you are hired as a hired gun to play session music in the studio, mm-hmm. and all the ways you can make money on your brand, yourself, whether it's doing a fan funding campaign or getting some sponsorship through a company or selling merchandise or trying to do, for example, running a YouTube channel that might have your music plus other things on it. So there's a lot of other ways. And in fact, we have a list of 42 streams on our website that documents how many ways musicians can make money these days. And just how you do it depends a lot on the roles you play, the genres you work in, and kind of on your career trajectory and the types of support structures, like teammates and memberships that you're involved with.
Yeah, teammates and memberships would seem to be really critical in that. Mm-hmm. scenario. Just listening to you talk, I was thinking that a musician might almost need Joel's background in economics to be able to figure out what all their revenue streams are and do accounting of them. Are people figuring this out, do you think, Kristen?
It's a challenge. The mm-hmm. Things are changing so quickly that it's oftentimes takes a moment to describe it to musicians about, especially because there's a difference between the composition, the music and the lyrics that you could say write on sheet paper, and the recording of the composition. Copyright law has always thought of those as different entities, and they actually have different exclusive rights. But mm-hmm. for the singer-songwriter who writes their own song and goes in and records it and then goes out and performs it, they tend to think of it as like one thing they're doing. This is like my stuff, my music. But that's where the confusion comes in sometimes, is because there's these different paths that money takes based on copyright law that musicians have to sort of take off their composer hat, put on their recording artist hat to be able to track and understand where the money's flowing. So we've done some, Future Music Coalition is trying to, help musicians navigate this stuff and understand it better. We have an infographic called Music and How the Money Flows, which documents and sort of shows how it flows from some of the common ways that music is used and performed and listened to these days, like Pandora or on the streaming services. And we've also been running these quizzes for the past year and a half to try and give musicians a sense of some of the complexity, but sort of in a fun and challenging way they can take the quiz and get a score and learn something while they do the quizzes.
Yeah, you guys have to check these out. They're at futureofmusic.org/moneyflow. No, that's your graphic.
Yeah.
The quizzes we have in our discussion points, they're a longer URL, but go check out the delicious links and you'll find them there. And they are really, really hard. I mean, even your easy one, I think you said had only they rank them easy, medium, and hard. And your easy one has only a 67% correct answer rate. So none of this stuff is very intuitive.
No. It's a lot for artists to digest and to remember, And the fact that it's changing simultaneously means there's a lot of explaining to do.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's talk about songwriters for a minute, since that has come up already in response to the YouTube announcements. As we've discussed on the show in the past, songwriters haven't been very happy with Pandora and have sought legislation that would raise royalties, have negotiated with Pandora over the years. And as far as I know, that's still a moving target. Am I right, Kristen? There's been no real happy resolution for both sides on that yet?
I think that if you're talking about the Songwriter Equity Act, I think that it's still in process. You know, things in Congress take a long time. There's been a number of hearings over the past year. These are somewhat contained in the umbrella of the Copyright Office's announced effort to reform copyright. They're calling it the Next Great Copyright Act. So there's been many, many hearings in Congress about that addressing specific issues in the on the copyright sphere. The, you know, songwriters themselves certainly have a number of issues just because a lot of the traditional ways that songwriters have made money are have been disrupted a lot because mechanical royalties that are paid when music is sold, when it's, well, it's when it's manufactured, there's a penny rate that is paid back to the publisher and the songwriter for every manufactured copy. And that still exists in the new field. So every digital download also has a mechanical license, a mechanical royalty. But as you get into streaming, those fractions of pennies become really, really small. And I think that the disruption on the songwriter side is really evident. And so the Songwriter Equity Act is, and other forms of legislation are trying to figure out if there's a better, if there's more parity that can be achieved through legislation or through negotiation.
Right. And just to echo something you said earlier, as we're talking about those fractions of pennies, still, we should bear in mind that for songwriters, that a lot of this is revenue that, that would never have come their way if what we were still used to listening to music on was FM radio. Is that right?
Well, the songwriters get paid on FM radio, the songwriters and the publishers, who the folks who are left out of the revenue chain on radio and terrestrial radio are the performers and the record labels. In the United States, that's been an anomaly and an issue that many, the Copyright Office itself and many other performers and record labels have tried to get fixed so that all four types of rights holders would be compensated for terrestrial airplay. That's been a big push for a number of years.
Okay. So in the meantime, though, we still have, we have the songwriters less than happy with what how they're being compensated on streaming services. And in response to YouTube's announcement earlier this week, there's a group headed by Irving Azoff, who used to be the chairman of Live Nation and now has a group called Global Music Rights, where he represents a number of artists, including Pharrell Williams, The Eagles, John Lennon, and various others. And he's not waiting around for ASCAP and BMI to confront this issue. He's threatening to pull these artists out of YouTube's service because he doesn't like the way YouTube is compensating songwriters. Do I have that right?
Yes, you do.
And so what do you think of this?
Well, I think, you know, Irving Azoff is a very smart and very powerful manager and represents some very powerful artists. So I can see why you know, I can see why he might use this as a negotiating tactic. I do wonder about whether if he's trying to set up kind of a boutique PRO that represents a very small batch of artists, I wonder about the rest of the revenue that PROs tend to collect, performance rights organizations like ASCAP, BMI, and CSAC. In the United States, they collect for all terrestrial airplay and everything that's played in, say, stadiums or on cable TV. There's a lot of different folks that they collect money from that then they distribute to the publishers and songwriters. And so I do wonder about the other places where PROs are typically active and what Mr. Azoff's plans are with those platforms. I just don't know.
Right. Joel, are you looking at the various, the variety of music services that are available today and thinking about at all which one is likely to be the one that we're all listening to in 3 to 5 years? Do you see an economic model that is more successful both for the performers and artists and labels and also for consumers?
I think it's hard, pretty hard for me to say. I think, you know, one thing that's pretty clear is that now that music is not being distributed or doesn't need to be distributed physically, that a lot of the benefits of bundling lots of music together and selling it as a bundle, the way that Pandora does, the way that Spotify does, I mean, mm-hmm. and they don't sell it, they really sort of lease it. That certainly has a lot of appeal because there's a lot of economic benefit, both to sellers and buyers, by selling big bundles. So I don't think that sort of a model is going to go away. But I guess the question is, you know, is it going to be interactive or non-interactive? And I, you know, frankly, the jury is out on the extent to which use of a Spotify or a Pandora stimulates or displaces sales. So it's really hard to know. I mean, the industry is in a lot of upheaval. And I think only a fool would make a prediction. So I'm going to try to not do so.
Okay. Well, let's look at some specific features. I'm interested in the way that Spotify lets you save things to be able to listen to and not stream them. Kristen, maybe you can go under the hood for me here and tell me exactly what's happening there. Is it a download service like iTunes accomplishes, where you're actually buying and downloading music when Spotify does that? So is that a component of Spotify's business model, or are they somehow lockering it? I'm a bit mystified as to how that works, I guess I should say. And do you know?
Well, I think they call it caching, like offline caching.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But my technical understanding of that and the licenses associated with it, I don't know about. I imagine that they had to negotiate the offline caching with the big rights holders in order to be able to do it.
Mm-hmm.
But so, I don't know the technical background.
Right. I mean, Joel just hit on something that's very important there, that with a lot of these services, you don't own the music. You don't even own the music in iTunes, but at least you have a physical copy of it. And I think it's an important distinction, but it does seem to be the way of the future, the way that takes the middle ground that makes the rights holders happy because they get paid and makes the consumer happy because they have access. Do you think it makes a big difference, Kristen, whether you own or rent your music as long as everyone's happy?
I think that there's, Joel was kind of saying this too. I mean, there's probably room for multiple versions of this. And I do think streaming from a central location via some means and whatever company is probably going to be the most common thing happening in the future. But there's at least two options that we already see. You know, like some people really want to be really invested in what they're listening to. I want to listen to this record or this album or this single. I'm going to put together this playlist of my favorite songs or whatever. So there's a number of platforms that do that. They're on-demand streaming services. But oftentimes people are like, I just want to listen to something. Like, I just want to listen to, you know, some Jackson Brown style music. And so those are kind of like Pandora or other services where there's a recommendation engine that powers the delivery of music, and it's a non-interactive service. I think there's room for at least those, both of them simultaneously, because it depends on the consumer's interest in actually taking charge of what they listen to. And there's still room for other services that are even more curated, like SiriusXM, the satellite service, which we shouldn't forget about since they have, I think, over 20 million subscribers who are paying money every month to listen to SiriusXM. And there's DJs and curated lists of all sorts of stations. And then there's traditional radio that's still out there, sometimes still considered, you know, when consumer surveys, a very important part of the music discovery service that is, you know, delivering, you know, a very specific and usually quite short playlist of music to a really wide audience. And then, you know, all the webcast versions of stations all over the world. So I think consumers can benefit from the options and the choices that are out there. And I'm not sure who will win, because it's really hard to predict just There may be enough of a consumer interest in multiple versions of this for more than one thing to survive.
All right. Let me see. Suzanne, you probably don't remember MTV in its heyday when people would just turn on the channel, and this was my childhood, and let the music videos play, you know, and you wouldn't get any choice over whether they were playing or what they were playing. But you know, people liked it. They would just leave that on in the background. And it seems like the new YouTube service might bring that MTV kind of vibe back, where you're just in a constant loop of music videos that are not even a loop, but just, you know, one after the other in either customized for your tastes, or because you've picked a certain artist that, like Pandora does, you like that artist and similar artists, and that it, you know, that this would be something that could take the streaming services, which I think have been how people have started to listen to their music. I know I've got people in IRC screaming at me, they're going to have to pry their actual local copies of media from their cold dead hands. But I think a lot of people stream these days, and this would add a video component to it. Am I wrong? Do you think people don't want to see the Taylor Swift video while they're listening to her tune?
I'll be honest, I don't watch a lot of music videos. Usually mm-hmm. I will only watch the music video of a very specific song if I hear that song on the radio on the way to class mm-hmm. and want to see the video. But the Pandora-style general mood music is what I tend to go for. So mm-hmm. I could see that as being a really interesting option for people that are into the videos.
Right. All right. I'm going to go around as we kind of close out the music discussion here and start talking about games for a bit. I'm going to go around to each of you and just get your final thoughts on the topic of music today, music revenues today. Joel, I'll start with you.
Sure. One of the reasons that this is this could be more interesting if we disagreed with each other, but you have reasonable people on this show. You know, if yeah. we were to represent the perspectives of the major record labels here, we could actually have some fireworks, right? So they're telling us that the sky is falling and we need to do all kinds of fairly intrusive things to solve the problem. And the problem in their mind is their revenue, which is not mm-hmm. the same as the problem that society needs to solve, which is to have a bunch of good music come forth for consumers. And you know, artists have to not starve. But I guess it would be, in some sense, we need the big media guy from Central Casting to say something that is persuasive in Washington, but not very reasonable. Then we could, you know, have a field day and a feast and maybe make for some interesting video.
Right. All right. Well, we'll stay tuned. I'll see if I can get some record label execs to join us on a future show. Kristen, what do you think?
It's a really interesting time, and I should sort of say that the reason that we did the artist revenue stream work actually is really reflective in what we've been talking about. Mm-hmm. Up until 2011, there was a lot of conversations about how musicians were making money and a lot of assumptions that this new democracy, this new available, you know, the availability to the market, being able to participate in the marketplace, was just like, oh, it must be great for musicians. We've broken down all these barriers, but no one had ever actually collected data from musicians to ask how much money was getting in their pockets and what kind of money it was, you know, what from what sources. So that was the reason that we did the artist revenue streams work starting in 2010. And in mm-hmm. 2011, we did a big survey and we did interviews and we've done financial case studies that look at the actual income and expenses of musicians over time, because we really wanted to come to this question with better evidence of, like, just something for us to have a sense of how it was for musicians themselves. In a perfect world, we would love to replicate this work in the future so we can actually measure change over time to see how musicians are faring in this marketplace, which is absolutely changing. And in fact, you know, as an outgrowth of the artist revenue streams work, we've, you know, tried to not only describe the marketplace and give musicians tools to figure it out, but also better describe how the money flows so they can participate, you know, in a way, so they can understand how to participate and what their options are, so they can be smarter about it.
Yep, that makes perfect sense. I guess before we leave the topic of music and before I get Suzanne's final thoughts on that, there's a good question from, actually, it's more of a rant in IRC that from Silicon Riot saying, let Pandora, iTunes, etc. sign deals directly with artists! Exclamation point, exclamation point. From your perspective as an indie musician and an indie record label proprietor slash custodian at this point, do you think that that's feasible, that the distribution channels would be dealing directly with artists at some point?
It would be a lot of work. It would be a lot of work if I had to go strike up a deal with every service. And say, like, hey, here's our 70 releases. So what we do is we use an aggregator called The Orchard that represents us in the marketplace and, you know, goes to delivers our music and then collects the money, and then we get a statement and revenue every month. For me, this was a fine solution. And there's plenty of other artists. There's plenty of other aggregators that represent unsigned artists, for example, CD Baby and TuneCore, that make it quite easy for musicians to participate. And it's, sure, that is a middleman, but it's usually the, you know, for example, TuneCore gives you 100% of your royalties and CD Baby gives you 91%. So the odds are in the artist's favor, at least as far as the payments go. I'm not sure, besides Bandcamp, where you do kind of set up your own page and you do your own thing, or SoundCloud, where you're uploading your own music, oftentimes the services want to deal with the aggregators and the big labels because the overhead of dealing directly with artists would be, I think, pretty significant.
Yeah, I could see that. So, Suzanne, you are coming at our discussion today from an indie perspective as well. Do you have any final thoughts on music, given your gaming background, that you want to share with us today?
I'm mostly just really excited about the democratization of the tools and seeing all these people doing things themselves and distributing it directly to me. The issue of where it's coming from via Pandora and SoundCloud and all these other services hasn't been something I put too much thought into, but it'll be interesting to see where things settle.
All right. So I'm going to put our first MCLE passphrase into this episode of the show. These are phrases that we insert randomly into our programming so that if you are listening for continuing legal or other professional education credit and you have an oversight board that wants some concrete proof that you actually listened, you can say, hey, well, I know the passphrases from this show. Our first passphrase is going to be a name. It's going to be Chrissy Hynde. Another blast for IC. I used to watch her on MTV. So she'll be our first passphrase today. If you want more information about getting continuing legal education or other professional credit for the show, head on over to wiki.twit.tv and find our show page there. We've got lots more information there for you. The other thing I want to do before we shift gears here and talk a bit about games, it's not quite a dramatic shift based on the fact that we the revenue and copyright considerations all kind of carry over. But I do want to thank our sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law, which is NatureBox. Now, I found another great use for your NatureBox snacks. We were talking about how you might have a more healthy Halloween treat on hand during our last episode. Between that episode and today, I took a long plane flight, and having NatureBox on the plane was just awesome. So many airlines now give you very limited options as to what you're going to have available to eat. And rather than, you know, getting the cold mac and cheese that they've warmed up for you, you might think about bringing your NatureBox snacks on board because they are every bit as delicious as those other bagged snacks that might be made available, and they're probably going to be more healthy for you. Right now, NatureBox is giving you a chance to get a complimentary trial box of their most popular snacks. You're going to pay just $2 for shipping. That's it. So drop that candy bar or potato chips. They're not good for you. Do what I do. Bring what I bring on the plane. You want these delicious, wholesome snacks from naturebox.com. NatureBox has hundreds of delicious snacks. I don't feel guilty about eating them. I don't feel guilty about giving them to my family because, you know what, they're better for us. They've got zero artificial flavors, colors, or sweeteners, 0 grams of trans fat, and no high fructose corn syrup. Boom. You know, what do you look for when you pick up the nutritional label? All those red flags, they're not going to be here with your Nature Box snacks. You'll even find snacks with no added sugar and without gluten. So in the afternoon when you're hungry, do what I do. Grab lemon pucker pistachios from Nature Box, or strawberry Greek yogurt pretzels, or mango orange fruit chews, or any number of amazing, wonderful variety of other things. You have to go to their site and really look through their selections. And that's how you're going to tailor what they send right to you. They're so good, and they're so much better for you than other snack options out there. So start your trial today. Get a complimentary sampler box at naturebox.com/twit. Stay full, stay strong, start snacking smarter, and get on over there to naturebox.com/twit. Thank you so much, NatureBox, for your support of This Week in Law and for keeping me adequately and healthily fed on my recent plane flight. Okay, let's talk about games. Interesting crossover of game law and copyright law this week is that the EFF has filed a petition for an exemption to the DMCA to let gamers keep running online games that someone may have let fall into disrepair. And again, this kind of thing, I'm looking for a lot of crossover between gaming and music on the show, I know it, but you could certainly see this kind of an exemption being important, not just in the gaming world, although this one would just apply to games, but as we're moving more and more toward music services that exist online and where you're renting the music and you have paid for the privilege of doing so, you could certainly see someone wanting an exemption to keep an online music service flowing too if it went the same direction. Can you tell us a bit more about this, Suzanne?
Yeah, this is a really interesting issue. There's a lot of gamers now that are in my age bracket that grew up playing online games, the servers for which have recently been shut down or have been shut down for some time. And they'd like to have the ability to go back online and play those games with their friends or people from across the world. The issue being that hosting their own server would violate the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. So in order to do that legally, the EFF petition is trying to get an exemption for those kinds of activities only for people that own legal copies of the game and only for people that are using the servers that are within the exemption.
That would be really great if it works out. What's your best guess? Again, don't want to put you on the spot, but I know that the way these exemptions work, and we should remind people that the way these exemptions work is they have a 3-year shelf life. If you can convince the Copyright Office that your exemption from the anti-circumvention provisions of the DMCA is a good, valid one that should exist, then you get 3 years to operate in that manner. And then it goes off the books and the Copyright Office has to consider it again. So tell me, Suzanne, if you think this is one that you think has a good chance.
I would very much like to see it happen. And I think if we can show the rights owners that there is a legitimate way to ensure that those playing on the servers have purchased copies or that this will result in more copies being purchased, there's a good argument for it. But I am on the conservative side of saying it's probably not going to happen because games companies, particularly large ones, are notoriously protective of their intellectual property rights, particularly under the DCMA. In the past, Blizzard has shut people down for using bots to farm experience points in World of Warcraft. So any hole in that whole blanket of protection they have is not something they would be interested in giving up.
What do you think, Kristen? I would imagine that music rights holders, particularly the big labels, would feel similarly about someone seeking an exemption to operate a defunct music service. The considerations might be a bit different. It might be hard for all the users to show, yes, I actually bought a copy of all these songs, but we know what happened to MP3.com all those years ago. Yeah. And we know that lockering sites have certainly had trouble. What do you think?
You know, the closest issue is actually Orphan Works, which is... Mm-hmm. an issue where, you know, you're not sure who owns the copyrights. And is it, you know, say it's like a, you know, a song that was originally written in like 1930 and you don't know who owns the publishing or the, or even the sound earlier sound recorded versions of it. And say you're a label that would like to release a box set of, you know, Appalachian songs or something, and you can't figure out whether you, who to approach to get a license for it. That's kind of what an Orphan Works issue is in the music world. And this is still quite unresolved. You know, there hasn't been much flexibility about the, you know, somebody doing their, you know, their very best effort to go find, sort of documenting their effort to go find the original rights holders, and say they can't find it, saying like, well, I'll just release it. And if somebody comes to contest it, you know, I'll stop, you know, doing that kind of work. There's still a lot of uncertainty about Orphan Works themselves and just how much work the sort of new user needs to put in order to be able to make something available that, you know, has an unclear background. So that's kind of what's going on, I think, in the gaming world too.
Yeah, and of course,
that's the closest I can think of corollary. So, yeah.
Right. I wouldn't be surprised to see not just the gaming rights holders, but also music rights holders getting involved in the discussion on this proposed exemption, and not just to protect their own abilities with respect to music services down the road, but because there's music in games, right, Suzanne?
Yeah, there is, and that's often licensed from the music creators.
Right. I mean, it cracks me up, but sometimes my there will be a link at the end of a game, and my son will be so excited just to go play the soundtrack from the game because they've fallen in love with the music in the course of playing along. So I imagine there's a lot of nostalgia and a lot of utility in the music that gets put into the games as well. Do you wrap your head around that one? So say this exemption passes and people are able to host their own servers, how are they going to deal with the music rights?
If you're asking me, I don't think the rights would transfer. I'm not a lawyer, so I'm just guessing. I don't think the rights would transfer to a second user, if you will.
Right.
I think it would be a problem.
It's the kind of thing
like you hear about sometimes when people are trying to do documentary film work of like famous artists or musicians, and they have trouble clearing the music that the documentary subject wrote or performed or something. Oftentimes the ownership of the music may not rest with, you know, the people you're you know, doing the documentary about, things like that. It's like this complex layer of ownership that gets challenging.
Right. So what do you think about that, Suzanne? Would someone running their own server have to worry about accounting for and paying royalties?
I don't think so. The rights transfer with the game. So as long as they were able to make sure that they were legitimately purchased copies of the game, how the server is hosted is a completely separate issue.
Right.
Because a lot of these also have offline components that contain the same soundtrack. For example, Grand Theft Auto. I have the soundtrack in my car whenever I'm driving around, but I also have a similar soundtrack when I'm playing online. So it doesn't matter the online component, whether or not the music is licensed for the game as a whole.
All the online component does is enable people to play with one another. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay. So speaking of something that involves a whole lot of social play and iterative building, I've brought this up, I don't know, probably 5 or 6 times on the show already, but now I have someone who might actually be able to say something intelligent about it. The acquisition of Minecraft by Microsoft. I think this is a huge deal from an IP perspective, as someone who, first of all, an enormous amount of money changed hands to Mojang to purchase what they did. And secondly, the product that Microsoft purchased is one that is so very much grounded in like nothing I've seen before in contributions from third parties to create its value. All of the various worlds that people can play with Minecraft, all of the mods, etc., those were created by users and not the company from whom Microsoft bought the company or bought my, the game. So I keep waiting for the other shoe to drop on this. There are so many ways that Microsoft could muck it up. And I haven't seen it happen yet. It's only been a couple months. But I'm wondering what you think, Suzanne. Is Microsoft going to blow this?
I think Microsoft is going to tread very carefully because this acquisition is, in my opinion, very little about the actual game itself. This is about buying an entire generation of users and their loyalty for a very long time. There's a huge number of people that were very into Halo and still are. And you hear that Halo sound effect. You hear that Cortana is going to be on the Windows phone. These are triggers in your brain, and you get excited and happy. It's similar with Minecraft. If Microsoft in the future, when these kiddos are reaching the college level, is able to integrate something Minecrafty into perhaps a word layout or something like that, they're going to draw in a whole new generation of users, or maybe a Minecraft themed PC for your office that does all of these things but has this cool layout, a whole new generation of users. So really it's about integrating the existing IP in new ways to maintain a user base.
But what do you think about the fact that Mojang may not have been the biggest or most ideal target for someone who is a rights holder, who is worried about, you know, making good cost benefit decisions in whether or not to pursue an infringement lawsuit. And, you know, where if you're, I don't know off the top of my head who owns the rights to SpongeBob, for example. Someone big does. And I'm sure the chat room will shout it at me in a second. If they wanted to pursue Mojang for all of the mods that incorporate their intellectual property, you know, that might be one where they just say, you know, not going to do it. But Microsoft now, that's a much more attractive target. And it's not, you know, SpongeBob is just the one that popped into my head right now. You think of any popular cultural artifact out there, and there is a Minecraft mod that involves using creating a world around that artifact or the artifacts in whatever world that is. And if you doubt me on this, go check out our show OMG Craft, where Chad, OMG Chad in our studio, takes you in detail through a lot of those mods. So do you think, Suzanne, that Microsoft's just not going to be able to, at some point it's going to have to put up the brakes and keep itself from getting sued out of existence from the likes of J.K. Rowling, aren't they?
Mojang always had a clause in their contract saying that you couldn't use any copyrighted materials within their space, their world. And on a few times they actually imposed that on people, particularly when people went into the realm of making movies for distribution in Minecraft. There was a Kickstarter not too long ago where people were going to film a movie about Minecraft. And they said it was fine. Mojang lets this stuff slide all the time. And Mojang came in and said, no, it's not fine this time. We're drawing the line here. So there has always been a line. And how that line interacts with fan works depends on whether or not the IP holder wants to alienate their fans. I'm a big con goer. I go to conventions all the time. And when I walk the show floor, I see paintings of Wonder Woman, Spider-Man t-shirts, plushies of Minecraft characters that were obviously not licensed. And if one of those companies were to walk through there and shut that down, they would alienate their fans. So any attack on Microsoft now is going to have to be made with a grain of salt, thinking these are our young fans. They're building something because they love our things that much, and they're willing to put all this time and effort into it. Is this something I reasonably want to stop, or should we just let it happen? So I don't think Microsoft is really at risk of getting sued into oblivion, but Microsoft will be more likely to respond if they get a takedown notice.
Yeah, I think that's a good thought. Joel, what do you think about a business model that is grounded on, as Suzanne just put it, trying to keep the goodwill of your fans? What do you think that means for both sides of the economic equation?
Well, it's a toughie, but it's not an uncommon thing. I mean, think about Amazon buying Goodreads, you know, which is a a site with many reviews of books, and it's all really user-generated content. And people had thought that they were sort of participating to this little utopian world, and now it becomes part of Amazon. And I think Amazon probably feels an obligation to not mess it up in some sense. But at the same time, if you were worried about concentration of all the knowledge, all the information about which books are good in the hands of one entity, wow, that's a little scary.
Mm-hmm. It's a little bit like, I don't know, I think people begin to think that they, because they're not pursued and told to stop, that there is no legal basis for pursuing them or telling them to stop. You know, that it's this, you know, we have the ability, but we're not going to enforce kind of mentality that, you know, the second you have to enforce for whatever reason, or you choose to enforce for whatever reason, the universe all of a sudden is upended. And I, you know, that's my concern about Microsoft now being the steward of Minecraft. But again, nothing's happened for a couple of months now. So we'll just have to keep an eye on that one. Shifting gears for a minute away from the IP aspect of games, we were talking a little before the show started because I was asking Suzanne about ratings on Steam. Steam is a new thing for, in my experience, and trying to navigate that world. Not a new thing for Suzanne at all. And it turns out, in answer to my question, she thinks that there are ratings on Steam, and that in general, ratings for video games are completely at the behest of the developer, as it were. In other words, they can decide whether they want to be rated or not. There are all kinds of good reasons why you'd, you know, economic reasons why you'd want to be rated, because you get someone like clueless mom me who's being asked to buy a certain game and it doesn't have a rating on it, you're going to think twice, and you're going to have to do a lot of research, and your initial response is going to have to be no until you know whether it's Grand Theft Auto for your 8-year-old or not. So I wanted to pick your brain, Suzanne, for a minute on the notion of regulation of violence and language and other you know, things that regulators like to get involved in games, and sort of what you think this current state of that is. It seems to me that lawmakers have sort of decided the industry has this rating system and that's working. And if, you know, it's up to parents to really educate themselves about what the ratings mean and make sure that they're not handing Grand Theft Auto or something worse to their 8-year-old. Is that kind of your take as well?
Yeah, there have been about a dozen video game violence or video game censorship cases. One at least has reached the Supreme Court. It was about Grand Theft Auto, actually. Mm-hmm. California was trying to shut down the sale of violent video games to minors. Mm-hmm. And the Supreme Court found that video games generally are covered by free speech, and they are protected expression, and they have all of those rights. So you can't say that an entire type or group of video games is not allowed or illegal. In response to that, in part, the ESRB was formed, which is the rating board for video games, which is the ET and everything else we see here in the U.S. The EU has a similar board, and so does the UK, is my understanding. Mm-hmm. But generally, that's entirely in-house. The video game industry handles that. It's a board within the industry, and you have to, when you complete your game, send in a copy, and they go through it and decide whether or not it's worth giving a T rating to, or an M rating to, or even an AO, which is adults only, which most stores in the U.S. will not sell rating. Mm-hmm. And it varies a lot depending on who you get to review it. They have specific rules for what would get into a T or an E game. I told you before the show, I have some friends locally who submitted a game for review after they finished it, and they kept getting a T rating. And when they found out why, it was because of the fart sounds in the game. And because apparently fart sounds are for teenagers and above only. So it's a little bit unpredictable about, right, especially when you consider standards of general society, but it is entirely in-house. There was actually a law just passed in Indiana, and it was upheld by the federal court there, prohibiting children from playing violent and sexually provocative video game arcade games without parental consent. So that will be, I'm sure, going somewhere else, and interesting to see.
Yeah, we'd have to share that knowledge about the fart sounds with every little kid who has a fart app on their iPod Touch or iPad or whatever. I don't know how many fart apps there are out there. Probably it would be interesting to have that little bit of data, but I'm guessing there are thousands of them and that they're not all rated for teens. Okay, I think there's something else on the gaming front you want to bring up for us, Suzanne, before we talk about something that affects everything that is available online, and that is net neutrality. Any other thing you want to touch on before we move to that?
I would love to get into net neutrality.
All right, let's get into net neutrality. And we have a fun bumper for that one, too. Low bandwidth to that. All right, so we've talked about the Spotification of YouTube. Let's talk about the White House-ization of net neutrality. President Obama came out with a statement, I forget if it was late last week or early this week, but basically attempting to give some guidance to FCC Chairman Wheeler on the net neutrality front, seeming to be pointing to the direction that the internet and our series of tubes that run it should be regulated more like a utility. So that would involve the reclassification of how the FCC is regulating the internet at present. And that's a very controversial issue. We've had tons and tons of shows debating that particular point of the net neutrality conundrum. So I'll refer you back to those. But it's interesting that the White House seems to be urging the FCC in that direction. Suzanne, what's your take on it?
I think it's important that we do something. I'm not entirely sure the directions we're going are the directions we ought to be going. I've heard the arguments that the internet, I've read the arguments, the internet unregulated has done so well so far, and it seems to be the right way we ought to go. But there was that issue with Netflix being throttled in response for not paying an additional fee for the amount of bandwidth they're using, which is insane, by the way. So something needs to be done to ensure that we're getting the right services, but the way the internet functions and the way telecommunications function and the way utilities function are not equal. So it needs an independent approach.
Okay, Kristen, this is obviously not just a big deal for the gaming industry, but the music industry maybe even more so since online delivery and streaming seem to be where things are going. Obviously musicians and their labels are going to want to reach the most people with the least amount of friction. So have you seen the industry as a whole take a stance on this? What do you think is going to be best for them?
Yeah, Future Music Coalition is one of many organizations that supports net neutrality. We've run a campaign since 2008 called Rock the Net that involves a lot of musicians of various profiles that agree with us that an open internet that doesn't have throttling or blocking is the best for musicians as creators and also for emerging, platforms. There's going to be music services that come down the pike eventually, and we want them to be able to enter the marketplace without having to pay some sort of exorbitant fees to be able to reach consumers. So, just like with Netflix, as Suzanne mentioned, they were, I think, being paid almost twice. They were having to pay twice for reaching consumers and not having their movies be, degraded. So Future Music Coalition has long supported net neutrality, and there's many other organizations in the music space that feel the same way, and have been urging the FCC to consider Title II reclassification, which would treat broadband it would reclassify it under Title II of the Telecommunications Act. But I think the president's statement earlier this week that had four clear points about, ISP shouldn't be allowed to block things, that there shouldn't be any throttling, there shouldn't be paid prioritization, and there should be increased transparency. Those are all really clear points, I think, that the FCC should take under consideration. And, you know, I should make clear, too, that there is also a connection with piracy, that the FCC always clearly states in their net neutrality work that they're talking about access to legal licensed services. They want to make sure that they're talking about the preserving an open internet that is encouraging access to like a legitimate marketplace.
Joel, do you think that there's room for new business models that that involve different pricing for access to different kinds of high bandwidth sorts of media?
It's hard not to say yes, just as an economist. You know, I think there's some of the scary scenarios here aren't sort of about neutrality versus not, but rather just about abusive monopoly versus not. Mm-hmm. You know, it's if we're going to price everything the same, sort of the way we do the Postal Service, regardless of what it costs to get your letter to Wyoming, where you're going to pay the same. I mean, that's a kind of a moral decision we might make, but it doesn't reflect the economic cost of doing business. It doesn't. And even in regimes that have net neutrality, there are all these ways to get around it by caching and so forth. You know, the market is going to find some alternative to net neutrality. It strikes me that the real issue for regulators is to worry about monopoly and gouging, not so much to enforce something like equal pricing.
Right. I do think that's a good point, and that the FCC is already incorporating that into their analysis and approach. Don't you think, Kristen?
I don't know if they're incorporating it as much as they need to. I mean, there's another issue coming right now with Comcast's merger with Time Warner, right? Is it Time Warner?
Yes.
So, you know, Comcast is arguing that, oh, you know, we're competitors. We don't have overlapping markets. This won't be a monopoly. But, you know, what Joel says is true, that there's going to be fewer actors of big, you know, large ISP actors in the marketplace if this merger goes through. But I think that's more Department of Justice issues and whether they can navigate the antitrust issues and get the merger cleared. But, you know, all these things start to overlap, and I assume that the different agencies are actually paying attention to what's going on, because policy about net neutrality will also be impacted by what Joel said, which is competitive marketplaces and whether there's competition to, you know, say the consumer's upset with one ISP, do they have a choice in their market, in their local market, to pick something else?
Well, the FCC has been wrestling with its revised open internet rule since early this year, and we're coming in at the end of the year now, and I do think that we can expect to see something concrete on this soon. I think that's why we're hearing from the White House at this juncture. So, again, this is something that there are a lot of very strong, passionate arguments on both sides. It is a very nuanced issue, and it's going to be difficult for the FCC to walk the right line. But we're just going to have to wait and see what they do, and wish them good luck in trying to get it right, because it's one that, as we've been discussing today, it's important that we get it right. All right. And as we're coming in here to the close of the year, Joel has done some really interesting research in his day that involves holiday shopping. And they're really, I mean, the tech law tie-in here is pretty tenuous at best. There are certainly tech tie-ins because of all the devices that people buy for one another over the holidays. Various subscription services perhaps might be a good holiday gift. And also, I think the other technology tie-in to the work you've done, Joel, is the fact that it's far easier now, although I don't know if it's as culturally accepted as it might one day be, to let your holiday wishes be known. Now, I would never do this myself, you know, make out a wish list and distribute it to my friends and family and say, you know, here's what I want for the holidays. But I think it makes it easier for people like grandmas and grandpas when kids do that. There's certainly, you know, there are certainly instances when you're going to buy someone a gift and you want your guessing on what they're going to want to be accurate. So there's a better ability now communicate that within a culturally acceptable way, I think is what I'm trying to say. So the work that Joel has done is to conclude that Santa is what is known in economic circles as a deadweight loss. And what that means, and I'm simplifying here, but what that means is that the money that people spend on gifts for one another would be better spent simply handing the recipient the money and allowing them to go out and buy what they want. The money that the recipient thinks the gift is worth, which is probably less than what the gift was actually worth. So hence the deadweight loss. You could actually spend the same amount of money and give the recipient more satisfaction by simply handing them the money. Of course, we have some cultural reasons why that wouldn't take place, but can you what can we plan on for the holidays, Joel, that makes sense to our pocketbooks and the would-be targets of our largesse?
Well, the first step toward solving any problems is recognizing that we have a problem, and I think one of the things that people don't traditionally think of is that gift giving is, and this is an inelegant thing to say, but it's a method of resource allocation. We don't think of it that way. We just think it's a way to express our feelings or maybe to fulfill obligations. But it is a method of resource allocation, just as going to the store and choosing things for ourselves is a method of resource allocation. And as it turns out, gift giving is a rather inaccurate method of resource allocation. Now, the thing is, though, the thing that makes this complicated is that it comes with some other things that, you know, that its elimination would also destroy. So to say that we shouldn't give gifts just because the gifts we give are unappreciated as gifts doesn't mean that they're not appreciated as gestures. So the real challenge is to figure out some way to allocate resources and give gifts in a way that both preserves all the good feelings for givers and recipients, but that doesn't cause recipients to end up with useless crap that they don't want.
Right. So what do you think about my wrinkle on it that as time goes on, you know, Amazon for one and probably many other places allow people to make lists of what they want. Does that help close the gap, or are we still culturally miles away from where, you know, someone like me would be comfortable or would even think about doing that?
I mean, in principle, wish lists are a great solution. I've seen them kind of pop up over the years, but I don't think they've really ever caught on because they do seem to actually break the tacky barrier and be really tacky. What has happened, though, and this has been kind of astounding, in the past 20 years, we've gone from gift certificates to being just negligible. They used to be these physical gift certificates sold for sort of the sole purpose that you'd lose them and so forth. But now we've gone over to gift cards. And they've exploded in popularity. I mean, something like a third of holiday gift giving is in the form of gift cards. And they seem to have escaped the tacky problem in the sense that recipients consider them to be really desired gifts. The National Retail Federation does these surveys. You know, what would you like to receive? Gift cards are really high up the list. So what's kind of amazing, it's almost like money laundering. It's a way to give people cash. It's not quite cash, but it's a light cash. It's a way to give cash without being tacky. So it's not so much that I'm advocating this. I'm more just noting that, well, as people have recognized that gift giving is a way to possibly destroy value, they've also decided, giving gift cards instead of giving cash is a great solution. And it's become enormously popular. I don't so much think it's a great idea as I just note that people like to do it.
Right. Susanna's our representative of the younger generation on our show. Do you have any thoughts or tips for people bearing Joel's research in mind?
As someone who's soon approaching the bar exam, which is a very expensive procedure, I would have no problem with receiving cash.
Yes.
a lot of my friends are very anti-gift card. So when we get together for Christmas, what we do is we set a limit, usually $20 to $25, and we find the worst possible gift. And then we just keep it based on sentimental value. One of my friends got a Shake Weight and a how to hand call for ducks DVD last year. And he still has it on his shelf, and it's always there when I go over to his apartment, and there's no reason why he would have it aside from the fact that it is hilarious.
That I love that idea. Try and buy the worst possible gift. Kristen, any thoughts?
I love Joel's research. I think I heard about it on Planet Money or something. I was wondering if there, I often get gift cards that sit in my wallet and then 2 years go by and I haven't done anything with it. I assume that the retailers just love the free money aspect of it as well. Is there something in your research about that?
Well, it is true. Something like, you know, 10% of the gift cards never get redeemed. And we're talking about $80 billion a year. So something like $8 billion a year doesn't get redeemed. In some states, it reverts to the state treasury. And you might think that's a good cause. It depends what political, you know, religion you have. In other states, it just reverts to the shareholders. Now there, it's not, at least it's not an economic loss. It's not inefficient. On the other hand, you know, you thought you were giving, you know, Junior a gift and you're actually giving the shareholders of Target Corporation a gift. So... You know, I have this, here's my soapbox idea I've been peddling for the last few years. Why don't retailers issue gift cards that say any unredeemed balance goes straight to charity after 24 months? I think they could get great PR out of this. They could claim that this is their charitable contributions as opposed to someone else's. I just think it's almost win-win, but nobody's taken me up on it yet.
Well, I like that idea.
Yeah, I like that idea too. We have some tips and resources for you before we go ahead and scoot on our way and work on fine-tuning our holiday shopping. The tip of the week comes to us from Senator Leahy, the head of the Senate Judiciary Committee, and he recently wrote a guest post over at Eric Gardner's site, The Hollywood Reporter Esquire. And it's a really good tip, and it crosses over. You wouldn't think that there would be a whole lot of crossover between the Supreme Court's recent conclusions on same-sex marriages and copyright law. But guess what? There is, because it turns out that copyright law is not only antiquated or in need of a second look when it comes to technology. It turns out that there are some provisions that aren't keeping pace with the fact that, what is it? I wrote it down before the show. I think it's 35 states now have, same-sex couples in 35 states and in Washington, D.C. can or soon will be able to marry. So the problem with that when it comes to copyright law is if you are a creator, a musician or a game developer or any other kind of creator or rights holder, and you are relying on copyright law to make sure that your spouse inherits your rights upon your demise. The way the Copyright Act reads is that rights are granted to surviving spouses of copyright owners only if the marriage is recognized in the owner's state of residence at the time he or she dies. So you can imagine how with only 35 states recognizing this, if you then moved to one that did not, you might have a problem if you're relying on copyright law to transfer your rights. So our tip of the week for artists who may have taken advantage of the fact that it is legal now in 35 states to become married if they are a same-sex couple, you're going to want to do some extra estate planning or otherwise take this into account, do some other kind of transfer of rights upon your demise, because the copyright law is lagging there. And Senator Leahy has a bill that would fix it. It's called the Copyright and Marriage Equality Act that he has introduced, and we will see what happens to that in Congress. But unless and until it is enacted, if you are in this situation, you're going to want to not just leave the disposition of your copyright assets to copyright law. I think that's good advice in general as to all your assets. You're not going to want to leave that to the whims of how whatever laws work. But in copyright law in particular, there was a good piece on that recently from Senator Leahy. Let's see. My other tip comes from a flurry of emails that I got in response to our recent episode where we were talking about whether you say data is or data are, whether data is a plural word. The consensus I got on that I love it when our readers write in to correct me and my initial intuition on it was right, is that it's perfectly okay in English to say data is. Data technically in Latin should be expressed as a singular datum, and then data would be the plural. But in English, we have mass nouns, and that you can say data is. So if you want more information on that, I encourage you to look it up. I'll read you one of the many emails I got. This one was from listener Doug. He gives some examples. Data can be plural in English. Here's an example. We have observed 3 instances of starlings nesting in jack-o'-lanterns. These data indicate a preference for rotting gourds. So nice and topical with our season there. Here's an example of it as a mass noun. We have examined the corpus of the Audubon Society. This data indicates a preference for rotting gourds. So thank you, Doug, and listener Tom, and other listeners who wrote in on that one, because it's hard for me to say data are, so now I feel good about not doing it. And then finally, our resource of the week comes from Suzanne. Suzanne had some really interesting musings on Twitter recently about crowdfunding a law firm. So I want to pick her brain on her thoughts on that front as well. But other than just musing on Twitter, she's written a great post on her Game Dev Law site, where game developers can find affordable legal assistance. And no, I don't mean LegalZoom, it's titled. And she has some great ideas here. And this, again, wouldn't just apply to game developers, but anyone who is finds themselves in desperate need of good business legal services, but without the unlimited or at least sizable legal budgets of a company like Microsoft. So she has some suggestions here of people you can approach and ways that you can get your legal services fulfilled. You want to tell us a little bit more about that, Suzanne, and also about your idea for a crowdfunded law firm?
Actually, I need to clarify that that post was from one of my contributors, Lauren. She's fantastic. And we've talked about this a lot. So
Lauren Hanley-Brady.
Yeah, she's fantastic. She's out in California. She's a wonderful waiting for her bar results, soon to be lawyer. And I told her to watch the show today because her post was on there. But hi, crowdfunding a law firm is a really interesting approach because you're seeing it more and more in the technology space. You can't have investors in a law firm that are non-lawyers. It's just against the rules. It will get you disbarred so fast it's not even funny. And you couldn't have tiers for legal services, but it does seem like, and the ABA has never said anything, you could crowdfund like the startup expenses as in office space, as in technology, and those kinds of things. And I don't think I'm bold enough to be the first one to try it, because angering the almighty American Bar Association is one of the worst things you can do, particularly prior to becoming an attorney. but it's an interesting thought that going forward with all of these new funding options, that's one of them.
Right. And then, you know, I do think that you and Lauren are right that someone will take crowdfunding and apply it to legal services at some point, and that there will be a way to do it without jeopardizing one's law license too badly. But in the meantime, there are other great alternatives that Lauren points out here, like thinking about law school clinics or incubator programs or nonprofits, new hires to law firms. This is a really, really good idea. If you are a small independent business and you need to find good quality legal support, new hires to law firms are, and new lawyers in general, new sole practitioners, although those are fewer and far more far between, are definitely in need of clients and in need of providing quality and more low cost legal services. So that's a great way to go. Also, game-specific law firms, which if Suzanne were to ever become affiliated with a law firm, I'm sure she would have a very game-oriented practice. So great ideas here. Thanks, Lauren, and thanks for joining us today at Suzanne's suggestion. And thanks to all of our panel for joining us today. This has been a really wide-ranging and really interesting discussion. Kristen Thompson, I know you guys just had your Future of Music Summit, did you not?
We did. We had it at the end of October in Washington, D.C. It was our 14th policy summit.
That's fantastic. What a great resource that is of getting people together to think about the kinds of hard issues that we've talked about here today. So you've got another year, and right? Are they a year apart?
Yes, they are.
Right.
But, you know, people can follow the issues at our website or our Twitter feed or on Facebook.
Yeah, absolutely. Really wonderful work you're doing at the Future of Music Coalition. And I really encourage people to go find the quiz page and try and wrap their heads around the very difficult hypotheticals. If you are a law professor who teaches in this area, they have some great potential exam questions on there that you're going to want to check out. And just for fun, just to see, and maybe just for sadness too, to see how difficult it is to be a musician and try and navigate these waters and really get your head around them. It's a wonderful, as you point out in your article, Kristen, that this is not just purely punishment. You're not just trying to make people feel bad about what they don't know. It's very educational. You get the answer to the hard question right there when you take the quiz. So that's very, very helpful. Joel Wildfogel, have a very pleasant winter in Minnesota. Is it already getting quite chilly there?
A little bit sooner than it should have.
Yeah. What else is going on at it is the Carlson School of Management that you might want to let people know about.
Oh, gosh. Well, we're always looking for people from the rest of the country and the rest of the world to come discover the wonders of Minneapolis. It's quite a cool place, and not just in the temperature sense.
Right. And you used to be at Wharton a while back, correct?
I was for quite some time. 13 years at Wharton, 7 years at Yale, and now back in the Midwest.
That's an amazing pedigree right there. We're so glad that you were able to join us today and share your thoughts with us on piracy and shopping and the future of music. And I'm glad that you've found that things are not that bleak there as far as, having music that has utility. And what did we say? Britney Spears and the Doobie Brothers. And as long as people are selling music, then things are good, correct?
It's a golden age for consumers.
Yeah. All right. Well, we're lucky to be living in it. And Suzanne, it's just been such a pleasure talking with you. Love the work that you're doing, the writing that you're doing. Good luck as you finish
Thank
up
you.
Law school and take the bar next summer. Anything going on at University of Chicago Kent Law School that you want to let people know about?
I mean, just the general stuff. It's an amazing intellectual property space to be working in. But the games industry isn't huge in Chicago ever since the fall of Midway. So the video game law space has a limited amount of things going on. There is a symposium in Chicago coming up in March, which I'm involved in planning. So looking forward to that.
Very cool. And I'm so glad that you are paying attention to all these issues. It's very encouraging as someone who's been practicing law for a long time to see students coming out of school with such great focus and ideas. So it's been a real pleasure to meet you.
Thank you so much. Great to meet you too.
All right. So folks, we hope you've enjoyed this episode of This Week in Law. If you've been joining us live, then you've done so at 11 o'clock Pacific time, 1800 UTC by going to twit.tv. That's where we record the show every week and you can play along with us. You can jump into IRC there too. Like the folks who have joined us today, we appreciate all of you being here and joining us if you could while we recorded live. But if you can't join us when we do the show live, don't worry about it. The show is going to be there for you after the fact, of course, on demand and preferably without getting throttled by your ISP in any way. If you go to twit.tv/twill, our archive of shows is there. And you can check it out. They go back quite a long way. If you prefer YouTube, just to click over from using their new Music Key service. We've got a channel there too. We're at youtube.com/thisweekinlaw. So you should find us there. We're on iTunes and on Roku. And there are all kinds of different ways you can consume the show, either on your computer or your television. So we encourage you to do so. What else should I let you know? You should get in touch with me between the shows. I'm Denise at twit.tv. You can find me on Twitter. I'm D Howell there. or head on over to our Facebook or Google Plus page and leave us comments there too. That's where we sort of incubate ideas before and after the shows, try and decide what our topics are going to be, get great ideas for new guests, and otherwise just talk about the intersection of technology and law when we're not here on the show. So do keep in touch however you prefer to. Love hearing from you. Love hearing that I can say data is as opposed to data are and not feel bad about that. And any other corrections, suggestions, et cetera, most welcome. So do keep in touch with us between the shows, and we will see you next week here on This Week in Law. Take care.